Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's our great pleasure to spend the hour with Senator George McGovern, who has a new book, What It Means to Be a Democrat. And it's really a heartfelt book that looks at issues that are of great concern to him. He talks about his vast historical perspective, his time in World War II, why he became a Democrat. His parents were Republicans, but FDR's programs really inspired Senator McGovern. He looks at food and hunger, issues that have been of vital concern to him for a number of years. The war in Vietnam, which was an issue that was of deep, deep concern to him for 10 years. Education, how we put Americans back to work, the environment, the Middle East, universal health care, which he believes strongly in, alcohol and drug addiction, and the list goes on. Senator McGovern, did I give you the name of the book? What It Means to Be a Democrat is the name of the book, and he was the Democratic Party's nominee for president in 1972, had a distinguished career in Congress, serving in the House of Representatives from 1957 to 1961. He was in the Senate for 18 years, president of the Middle East Policy Council in Washington for a number of years, and he worked on food programs for a long time. President Kennedy put him in charge of Food for Peace program back in the 1960s, and that has been an issue that has been of lifelong concern to him. He also had an extremely distinguished career in World War II. He holds the Distinguished Flying Cross for his service as a bomber pilot in World War II. Senator George McGovern, thank you so much for being with us.
It's always a pleasure to be on your program.
Thank you. It's great to have you here. I vividly remember when you were in our studio a couple of years ago and you were drinking a chocolate milkshake. You had a hunger for a chocolate milkshake and you were relishing every moment of it. It made me go out and get a chocolate milkshake after the program. You write in the book, and I really love the book. It's such a heartfelt look at issues that are of great concern to you, that you view the federal government differently, not only from Republicans, but also from many Democrats. How so?
Well, there's such hostility towards the United States government, especially among these candidates that are running for the Republican presidential nomination. I think we've had in our political history two great political parties, the Republicans and the Democrats, and we ought not to use the kind of excessive negativism and hostility towards the federal government that I hear being expressed, especially by these Republican candidates for president. One of the reasons I wrote this book is that I'm tired of all the negative flow of charges and countercharges that has taken over American politics. We hear what people are against, but I thought it was time to set forth what we believe, what we're for, not simply what we're against. Mm-hmm. So that's what my book is all about. It's an effort to state in positive terms what it means to be a loyal Democrat. Maybe we need a book, What It Means to Be a Loyal Republican, to get back to some of the really attractive traditions of the Republican Party instead of what we're getting now.
Let's go back in your life, because you grew up with parents who were Republicans, which is interesting, but you were captivated by FDR and the programs that he brought forward. And is it fair to say that he inspired you to become a Democrat?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I was brought up a Republican, like most people in South Dakota at that time. South Dakota is a little more balanced now between the two parties, but in my youthful days and growing up days, the Republicans pretty much had a clear field in South Dakota. But I thought it would be helpful just to state in as positive terms as I could what the Democratic Party has stood for over the years and what it ought to stand for today. And that's what my book is all about.
your book, to put it in a phrase here, is having a compassion for others. Compassion. It's a good word. It's a good philosophy.
Well, you know, the Bible instructs us to love one another. My Methodist preaching father taught that doctrine to us as we were growing up. I think it's at the core of good government, a sense of concern, a sense of involvement, a sense of trying to be a partner to the public and to the American people. So I started off in Chapter 1 talking about compassion. You know, we especially need to be compassionate towards those who are not as strong as the rest of us, the poor, the very young, the very old, the jobless. I really feel genuine compassion for people that can't find a useful job today. There are too many millions of them strung out across the country. And one way to put them back to work, if they can't find jobs in the private sector, is for the federal government to do what it did during the New Deal period of Franklin Roosevelt, and that is to come forward with some practical work that needs to be done, strengthening our national forests, our national parks, our roadways. We've got hundreds of bridges across the country that need to be strengthened or abandoned. We've got underground water systems, both water delivery and sewage, that are going out of condition. Those are all public works that I think would help put people back to work in a way that would be useful for all of us.
Your phrase is very direct when you, in your chapter about unemployment, the Democratic Party that you fell for did not tolerate unemployment. Do you fault the Democratic Party now, Senator McGovern, for tolerating unemployment?
I think we're not quite as vigorous as we should be in seeing that people get to work. Very few people like to just sit around and do nothing. And we can't afford that. We can't have the United States, which I happen to think is the greatest country in the world, with millions of people sitting on the sidelines because they can't find useful work. So, yes, I think the Democratic leadership, the Democrats in Congress, and even the White House need to take this unemployment problem more seriously than we have up to the present time.
Why did we let, one of the reasons that we have not had a lot of government help for people who are unemployed is that people, as you know, have been touting the deficit and are great concern about the deficit and leaving that to future generations, this huge debt. So they were mutually exclusive. We couldn't help people with jobs if we were simultaneously concerned about the debt.
Well, you know that the big debt that we have in this country, the national debt, does not result from hiring people. It doesn't result from things like the school lunch program or the WIC program for low-income pregnant or nursing women. Those programs are comparatively minor when you compare it to the cost of war. As a matter of fact, as a child growing up out in South Dakota, we didn't talk about the national debt. It was always referred to as the war debt, and that's what it was. Mm-hmm. It was the debt that accumulated in World War I. Now, today, you get the impression, listening to some of the critics of our government, including the Republican presidential contenders, you get the impression that somehow Democrats are careless about running up these big debts. Well, let's look at what happened in recent history. President Reagan was a congenial, likable man, but he did two things that added a lot of money to our national debt. Number one, every year that he was in the White House for 8 years, he sharply increased military spending. At the same time, he cut taxes for the people best able to pay taxes. Well, if you increase your spending and you cut back on your revenues, that means an explosion of the debt. And it went up $4 trillion during the 8 years that President Reagan was in the White House. The same thing happened with President Bush Jr. He got us into two wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, and cut taxes even more than President Reagan had. And again, we added $4 trillion to the national debt. Over half of this enormous debt that we now have stems from the war policies that drove that debt to the extent it is today.
Maybe we need to change the name. Call it war debt, huh?
Yes. That's over half of it is a war debt. It's not only a war debt, but it's the preparation for war. How many Americans know that it would take the 20 other largest military budgets in the world from 20 countries to equal our military budget? I believe in a strong national defense. That's why I participated as a volunteer bomber pilot in World War II, but I don't believe in wasting money on this overkill policy that I think both parties have tended to follow since World War II.
Senator George McGovern is our guest this hour. His book is What It Means to Be a Democrat. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. The email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Senator George McGovern. Scott in La Crosse, our first caller. Hi, Scott.
Kathleen, thank you ever so much to you and Rhonda for having this program today. And if you would indulge me for just a second, I'll get to my question. But before I do, Senator, I always liked and admired you, but then I had the good fortune of reading Stephen Ambrose's book, Into the Wild Blue Yonder, about that bomber service that you were speaking about. And, sir, after I read that book, I believe you are a national hero. Thank you so much for your service, for everything you've done for our country. Now, my question is, we hear a lot how the two parties have become so polarized and that the Republicans have moved so extremely to the right and that the Democrats have moved so extremely to the left. But then I've also heard some people say that really the Republicans have, yes, moved very much to the right, but the Democrats really haven't moved that much to the left, and really much more the party that you could still be a member of, which is, I think, unlike some of your Republican compatriots from your generation, who probably would not find a home in their own party. Would you care to comment on that for me, please?
Well, I think that's a good observation. You know, the Republicans have had some great men down through the years, beginning with Abraham Lincoln, generally regarded as the founder of the Republican Party. But there were the La Follettes in Wisconsin, Peter Norbeck in my home state of South Dakota. These were moderate-minded, if not liberal-minded, Republicans. And we need more of that today. Neither party has a monopoly on virtue or on wisdom. But we need at some point, when we're dealing with an issue, to get together across party lines and talk about a possible solution, and not a surrender by one party and a claimed victory by the other. I've been working with former Senator Bob Dole now for the last 10 years I was in the Senate, and for the years since then. We've worked together on anything that had to do with reducing hunger, either in this country or around the world. And I think that's what we need more of in American political life today. I personally don't think the Democrats have gone too far to the left. Where is the evidence of that? I think that President Barack Obama is following a more or less moderate course, as a matter of fact. I don't see where he's done things that are radical or beyond the reach of ordinary citizens. So I agree entirely with the analysis you've just described.
Let's spend a few more moments on health care, because we continue, as you know, to debate that and debate it and debate it, and then we get something passed and it becomes the focus of a presidential campaign to undo what's been passed. You call in the book, very simply, you say Congress should hereby extend Medicare to all Americans.
Well, I think that's a good, straightforward answer. As we began to deal with a proposal like mine to just simply extend Medicare, we might find a few places where the two parties could agree to even make an improvement on it. But it's where I stand on health care. When people quiz me, I say, we know what Medicare is. It means that the government pays all the medical bills and the hospital bills of people 65 and older. I, of course, have benefited from that ever since I turned 65, and I think it's a wonderful program. It's pretty much what most of the industrial countries of the world have, countries like Canada, England, Germany, France, and others, the Scandinavian countries. And it's really what we should have in our country. It brings the issue down to something that people can understand. I hear the Republicans blasting Obamacare. Well, I've read as much as I can about the proposals of the administrations, and I'd rather have that than nothing at all. I think it doesn't go as far as we should, but at least it's a step in the right direction.
And Senator McGovern, why is it so darn blasted hard to deal with that issue in this country? What is it about health care that gets everybody slightly crazy?
Well, as you know, there are very powerful lobbying groups that deliberately confuse the issue. They talk about the long arm of Washington reaching into our lives if we have health care. Well, I think the government should reach into our lives. The government belongs to us. We're the citizens that control it. It can't do anything without the approval of the American people and their elected representatives. And there's certainly nothing confusing about Medicare. It just simply means if you get sick and you need a doctor, if you have to go to the hospital, the government pays the bills. I don't find that a burdensome load to carry. I think it's a sensible way to deal with problems that sooner or later are going to hit all of us.
Mm. Let's go to Tom in Racine. Hi, Tom.
I was a page in 1957, 58, 59 in the House of Representatives when you were there. And my father was Charlie Boyle. He was from Chicago.
Yes, I knew him well.
and he was killed in a car accident in November of 59. Mm-hmm. And I've been on the radio here for the last 10 years bothering Kathleen Dunn. She's had to put up with me all this time. But anyway, I wanted to ask you this, Senator. In 1957, my father and you put the first Civil Rights Act through the Congress. It allowed black Americans to apply for federal jobs, and it was the first time since the Civil War that there was a bill passed to hell. It was the first civil rights bill ever after the Civil War.
Yes.
And I wonder if you can remember that, maybe say something about it. Because my father was in the cloakroom, and someone said he was going to shoot him or he was going to stab him. Or he was really mad at him because my dad was using a parliamentary procedure.
All right, let's get a response. Senator McGovern.
Well, yes, I remember that proposal, and it made sense then, and it still does. We can be very proud of the progress we've made in this country on civil rights. You know, we talk so much about our failures, but we've had some great victories under President Lyndon Johnson. We passed several really charter positions on civil rights. It guaranteed equal access to public facilities, regardless of race. We've made progress towards women's rights. When I went to Congress, women didn't have anywhere near the opportunities they have now. I've always thought these women are probably the stronger gender in our,
of course.
In our makeup. I got a lot of good advice from Eleanor when she was alive, and from my mother and others. I wasn't a pacifist, but my mother was. I remember one night when the South Dakota press carried a story that something like 6,000 German soldiers were killed in a battle, and my mother said, "Oh dear, there's so much sadness in those homes in Germany tonight. It, my heart aches for them." Well, now, these were the same Germans that were trying to shoot me out of the sky as a bomber pilot. But I admire my mother's sense of compassion. We need more of that in American life.
Let's spend a little bit of time, and you write about it somewhat extensively in the book, Vietnam, which consumed you for a decade until the last soldier left in 1975, you write, "The war in Vietnam was at the top of my mind. My anguish over our continuing involvement in that faraway country was the driving force of my public career." Why was it?
Well, because it was so wrong and mistaken that we had our young men and boys over there in that jungle dying every day, 58,000 of them that died, and several times that many who were wounded in either body or mind and are still suffering from it. I had those boys on my mind, I think, every day for years when I was in the United States Senate trying to end the war. Once in a while, some senator would get up after I had spoken and say, "Well, I want to say to the senator from South Dakota that I'm going to stand with our boys in Vietnam." I said, "Senator, you and I are not standing with those boys. We're here in an air-conditioned Senate chamber. We're surrounded by marble and mahogany desks and furnishings. We've got pages to run our errands for us. We've got our own dining room downstairs. That's not standing with our boys in Vietnam." I personally have been out there two times, and I'm going a third to be with them and to see what they're up against. But, you know, the way to stand with our men in time of war is not only to give them the benefits that they're entitled to when the war ends, but also to be sure that we've committed them wisely when we send them out to risk their lives. And that's what I pled for in Vietnam. I was always with our troops, and I thought the best favor I could do them was to end that war that threatened life for so many of them.
I know you've thought about this issue and changed your mind about it. What are your current thoughts on a draft?
Well, I used to be against the draft, except in wartime. Ted Kennedy was the person that set me to thinking about maybe it's wise to have a draft, if for no other reason And that would make us think very seriously about whether or not we ought to commit our soldiers to war if we knew that our sons and the sons of our acquaintance were also subject to going into that war. I think some of the opposition to the war in Vietnam ended when President Nixon, late in his term, ended the draft, called on Congress to end the draft. Once people didn't have to worry about going there unless they wanted to, the opposition to the war also went down.
Let's go next to Kelly is calling from River Falls. Hi, Kelly.
Well, good morning. It's an honor to speak to you, Senator. Kathleen, if you'll allow me to gush for a minute.
Go right ahead.
You're one of my heroes. The first three votes I ever cast for president were for Hubert Humphrey, George McGovern, and Jimmy Carter, and you're all my heroes.
Three pretty good men.
But I wanted to ask you about Paul Wellstone.
At least two of them.
Oh, let's say three of them. Sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
Okay. I've got some modern-day heroes like Bernie Sanders and Dennis Kucinich and Russ Feingold, but I wanted to ask you about Paul Wellstone. I miss him being on the scene. I think about him a lot, and I'm wondering if you could comment on Mr. Wellstone.
Well, Paul Wellstone had my highest regard because he always stuck with what he thought was in the best interest of the public and the country. He always stayed with what he thought were the great enduring traditions of this country. He was a good, decent, honorable man, and like you, I still miss his presence in the Congress. Could I just add one personal note? When I went to Congress in 1956, I was the first Democrat elected from South Dakota to high office in many, many years. I made one pledge to myself. I said I'm never going to advocate a public course for this country that I don't believe is in the best interests of the people that I represent in South Dakota and in the nation. And I've stayed with that. Never once did I ever say publicly something I didn't believe privately was the right course. Now, that doesn't mean I was always right, but it meant that I always said what I thought was right. Sometimes we misjudge things. We're all human. But that's a good guideline, I think, for any public official. Certainly Wellstone had that. That's not to say anything that you advocate publicly that you don't believe is the right course privately.
That's the way to live.
Yes.
That's the way to live. Thank you, Kelly, so much for your call. Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, I just wanted to say you were my first vote in 1972. I had just turned 18. You were, your daughter convinced me to volunteer to coordinate your New York State campaign in 84. I have worked at the World Food Program as a consultant off and on for years, seeing and hearing about the work you did in your ambassadorial position in Rome and elsewhere. This is not a comment on me. This is a comment on you. Whom do you see out there who can inspire people like you inspired me? And I will get off and listen.
Oh, thank you, Jeff.
Well, you know, that's a little hard for me to answer without sounding like I'm blowing my own horn. But first of all, let me just thank you for your kind words. That's what makes politics all worthwhile, to hear that kind of statement. I think there are a number of people who are capable of inspiring the country. I think President Obama is such a person. I think he'll be even better in his second term. You know, he's the first black man ever to occupy the presidency in the long history of this country, the first one. And he's probably treading a little cautiously, knowing that any mistake he makes will be magnified by his critics. But I honestly believe that if he is reelected this year, that he'll be an even stronger and more decisive president. He'll also be better acquainted with the office and what the White House demands of the occupant. So I look forward to a good second term for President Obama. I don't have much doubt that he will be reelected.
The caller, Jeff, mentioned his career pursuit based on you, actually, being concerned about the hungry in the world. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't spend at least a few moments talking about that, because in addition to Vietnam being the driving force of your public career, I think that your concern and service to trying to alleviate hunger in this world was also a driving force of your public career.
Absolutely. That concern has been the longest and most deeply held conviction. I went to Congress, actually, believing that it was very important for the United States to take a strong position to end hunger and malnutrition, not only in our own country, and it is important here, we still have malnourished people in the United States, but also around the world. We have those huge surpluses piling up, corn, wheat, barley, rye, oats, powdered milk, powdered eggs, and other things. And I wanted to see us use those surpluses overseas, and that's what President Kennedy gave me the opportunity to do when he named me as director of the Food for Peace program. I handled that program for the years between my service in the House of Representatives and my service in the United States Senate. And I've continued that interest even after leaving the Senate. I persuaded Bob Dole to team up with me on the so-called McGovern-Dole Food for Education and Nutrition. And that's an international school lunch effort that is now reaching millions of youngsters around the world. And I want to see that program completed. I'm going to turn 90 on my next birthday, July. Mm-hmm. I would like to have another 10 years, not simply because life is good. Mm. I want to keep it going as long as I can, but because it'll probably take that long with the help of Senator Dole and our citizens who feel the same way to end hunger in the world. But I'd like to achieve that before I say goodbye to this life.
Oh, I hope you won't say goodbye to it for a long time. Tell the story. It's a fun story in the book where you're with then Senator Kennedy, who's on a campaign swing, I believe in South Dakota, and he's got to speak to a group of farmers, and he gets it all wrong, and you propose an idea to him, and that's how you later become director of Food for Peace. But he didn't exactly know how to relate to farmers, and you taught him. I think that's fair to say.
Oh,
you taught him.
I had great affection for John Kennedy, but he would have been the first one to tell you that he didn't know much about the agricultural issues when he first arrived in the White House in early 1961. But he learned fast, and one way, he was out speaking during that campaign to about, I'd say, 10 or 15,000 farmers attending the National Corn Picking Contest near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And the wind was blowing, it was cold, and he had a speech that somebody had written for him that kept rolling around on the podium. He was trying to hold it down and gesture with the other hand. When we got back on his plane to go to my hometown, Mitchell, South Dakota, he said, George, what the heck am I going to tell those people? I understand there are 6,000 people jammed into that corn palace in your hometown. What do you think I can do to redeem myself? I said, well, Jack, the first thing I would do is throw away that speech. It's not much good anyway. Get rid of it and just walk out there and say to that family, I believe the farmers of South Dakota and North Dakota and Nebraska and Wisconsin, all these states, I believe they can do more to bring peace in the world than any other group of Americans. If we understand that food is power, food is energy, food is health, food is strength, it can strengthen the world and lead it to freedom and to peace. And if I'm elected president, I'm going to appoint a Food for Peace director to go to the White House and help me use our farm surpluses to wipe out the surplus of hungry stomachs in other parts of the globe. Well, he got elected. He didn't carry South Dakota, but he won by a very narrow margin nationwide. I was defeated that time in my first run for the Senate. And guess who was the first Food for Peace director?
You. I know. I love this story. I just love this story.
I love that job. Eleanor always thought that was the best job I ever had, feeding hungry people around the world.
Hmm. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Hi, Rich.
Good morning. I want to express admiration, but get right to my concern. I think we've been living through a really great international and national experiment in the globalization of labor. And on one level, it's been successful. That is, corporations are at free range and free will to use labor around the world however they care to use it, generally to the benefit of their bottom line. We have not been successful, however, in respecting the laborers around the world, including in our own country. And as evidence of that, I would submit that in Europe, Germany has not followed the exact same course as the United States of America. The Germans have determined that while they will have some low-paying jobs, they don't value those jobs as much as they do nation-building or family-sustaining jobs. I'd like Senator McGovern's comments on my perceptions in terms of whether I'm sort of on target, missing some points, or if he's in disagreement. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you. I fully agree with that point. I think labor is the backbone of our enterprise. If you don't have skillful laborers, in some cases, common laborers, you've got nothing in the way of production. It's those workers who go to the factories, who go into the mines, who go to their jobs every day, that form the real economic base of the country. And we've always had good working people in the United States. And I think that we don't pay enough attention to the conditions that labor faces. It's not only that many of them are unemployed at the present time and are unable to find work, but we don't show our appreciation enough in what we pay our workers for their labor. And that's why we need strong labor unions to make sure that those labor standards are as high as they should be in a great country like the United States.
Senator George McGovern, our guest this hour, author of many books. We're speaking about his most recent, What It Means to Be a Democrat. Our number, one line is open. Call at 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Tom in Minocqua. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Senator.
Good morning.
I'm kind of out of the loop because everyone's talking about how they voted for you. And I, if I had been voting in 1972, I think I would have voted for Nixon, which I think is why 12-year-olds are given the right to vote. And you've covered so much territory already this morning, but I guess I just wanted to maybe ask you to talk a little bit about how we can change people's perspective on taxes. I actually had a great opportunity to talk with Senator Ellen Simpson at the airport in Chicago last spring. He was waiting for a long time, I think, and was more than eager to chat. And, you know, and one of the things he talked about are all the things people want to do and wars and everything else, but we don't want to pay taxes. And even though many of those proceeds will benefit ourselves and the things that we appreciate and take for granted. So maybe we could just talk about that a little bit.
Well, I agree with the thrust of your statement there and your question. It's really a privilege to pay taxes in a free society. Just consider all the things that those taxes do. I'll take one, for example. It was passed in a Republican administration, the interstate highway system. When I'm sailing down those interstate highways, it just makes me feel glad that I was able to help pay for them. You go to the great national parks and the great national forests. You go to the protections we have to guarantee us pure food and drugs. You think about Medicare. You think about all of our great environmental programs. Even national defense. National defense is paid for by taxes. So it's in my opinion, I get more out of the funds I pay in taxes. It's a better investment for me than any other money I earn. So I think taxes ought to be thought of as a privilege. We don't want to pay more than our share, and we don't want to see some others slipping through loopholes so they don't pay what they should. But nonetheless, there's too much criticism of taxes and not enough awareness of the good things in our lives that are produced by those taxes.
The caller mentioned Richard Nixon, and I was interested in part of your book where you talked about going to Pat Nixon's funeral and some people wondering, well, why in the world would Senator McGovern have done that? And you had a chance to speak with President Nixon at that time. Why did you go to that funeral?
Well, because I had been tied to the same historic period of life. Mm. That Mrs. Nixon and her husband, the president, had lived through. And I wanted to show that there are some things that run even deeper than party loyalties. It isn't just simply that she was a famous person, but she was one that was involved in my life in important ways, as was her husband. I also went to President Nixon's funeral. There was just a small group of people that were at the funeral for Mrs. Nixon. It was out in the yard around the Nixon Library in California. We were sitting on folding chairs. There might have been 100 people there. President Nixon was obviously grief-stricken by the death of his wife, his longtime wife, his only wife. And so I was glad that I went, and I was glad that I appeared at President Nixon's funeral later on.
Are we in a period, or has that period passed and we need to bring it back, Senator McGovern, where we remember that there are some things in life that do run deeper than party loyalty?
Yes, I think so. You know, I had four daughters and one son. I loved them all dearly. And wonderful Eleanor, my wife, 63 years before she died some 4 years ago. Those are things that run so deep that they're a part of our very being, I think. There's also loyalty to principles that I think should run higher than any loyalty we have to a political party. Political parties are important. I think we need a good, solid, conservative Republican Party. I think we need a good, solid, liberal Democratic Party. But they're not the end-all of human loyalties.
Thank you very much for your call, Tom. And let's go to Carl is next in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Howdy. Kathleen, I've met Senator McGovern and has been confronted by a question that drives me, or a statement that drives me apoplectic. I have a very good friend who is of the opinion that government can't do any good. It's the cause of all kinds of problems, never the solution. And, you know, he's never said this, but he's got the same attitude that I forget who it was said, make government small enough so you can drown it in a bathtub. And he sort of started to address this question or problem when he mentioned a response to the question about taxes. But, Senator, how do you respond? I'll bet your book has something to say about it.
Yes, I'm not quite clear on what you were driving at there. There was a little bit of a break in the phone here. Can you just restate that in a couple of...
As quickly as possible, the attitude, how do you respond to the attitude that some people have that government can't do anything right, it's always wrong?
Well, let me speak to that. Listen, the government does plenty of things right. Let me just cite one example. When I came back from World War II, I was then in my early 20s. I had Eleanor as a wife, and we had one child and another one on the way. Anyway, when I came home, the government, federal government, came forward with the GI Bill of Rights. And what that did was to permit 8 million soldiers from the war to go to any college or university they chose. And the government paid everything, tuition, books, fees, plus a cost of living stipend. It was a marvelous program. And I've never heard it faulted by anybody that was familiar with it. What it did was to give us 8 million well-educated, experienced young people who had a college degree to go out into our society and serve. You know, it did cost a lot of money, but the interesting thing about it, a Budget Bureau study later on showed that the government recovered twice as much money as they spent on that program. Why? Because by educating us, they raised our earning power for the rest of our lives. We were not only better able to serve society, but we got paid more, and therefore we paid more income taxes to the government. So the government just collected a nifty $2 for every $1 they had spent on that program. Mm-hmm. That's a working government program.
Senator McGovern, a great pleasure to speak with you. Have a happy birthday early, and long, long may you live, sir.
Thank you so much for having me on your program.
Our pleasure. Senator George McGovern, our guest this hour, his book is What It Means to be a Democrat, and he covers so many of the issues that are of great concern to him. Time didn't allow us to get into all of them, but we tried to hit the major ones. Thank you, Rhonda Fanning, for producing the hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning as well for on-air production here in our studios. Thank you for listening.